Hi, this is the Deco Podcast, and I'm your host, Saurabh. I'm joined by my co-host, Siddharth Jain, who's the co-founder at Deco and is also an angel investor. Today, we are thrilled to host Anirudh Pandita, who is the founder of Loco and Pocket Aces. Loco started off with an aim to democratize gaming entertainment, and Pocket Aces is one of the leading digital entertainment companies in India with channels like Filtercopy and Dice Media. Anirudh himself is an avid gamer and has done his MBA in finance from Wharton. So he has an experience in finance, marketing, as well as gaming. Through this conversation, we aim to understand what Anirudh's views are on Web3 gaming or gaming in general. Before moving on, Deco members or guests appearing on the podcast may own assets that we discuss here. Nothing we say here is a financial advice, and all the opinions mentioned here are our own and do not reflect the views of any organizations that we belong to. With that, let's jump right in. Anirudh, I mean, we have been talking to various guests on this podcast, but your background is strikingly different from all pretty much almost everyone that we have spoken to. Can you just walk us through your journey?
I think when you were saying that I worked in marketing and in finance, and actually when you start a company, you work in every single different area of company building in general, whether it's HR, finance, marketing, product, tech, you work in every single one. I've also had the notoriety of, you know, actually acting in content, or as I say, acting badly in content. So I've worked in every single different sphere of company building, and doing all of them, you realize how bad you are at each one, and you gain more and more respect for the sector specialists. My background, as you guys know, born in Kashmir, grew up there for a bit, then moved to Delhi and then to Kuwait, where I grew up. So grew up pretty much as a immigrant kid there in the Middle East. Learned a lot about life through sports. Learned a lot about life through watching television. So, you know, I always say whatever your parents are telling you not to do, or, you know, there might be some value in building businesses in that sector. But yeah, you know, went to school, did undergrad at the University of Illinois, where I really learned how ventures are built, saw that innovation-based ventures could actually make it out. I think before that, you know, India, there was always this license raj culture, right? And I think we are now lucky to live in an age where, you know, companies like Flipkart and so on have really set a good benchmark for what just normal, you know, people can do. And I think for me, that happened in college, and seeing, you know, Mark Andreessen and written the browser on the Illinois campus, Max Lepchin from PayPal was there. So I was from there. And so you got this confidence that, yeah, even you could build something. And after that, I worked in banking and private equity, really learned how businesses are created, how they die, how capital markets play a part in that, how businesses get resuscitated. And then you have kind of these giant multi-decade multi-baggers, whatever word you want to use for them, but businesses that really stand the test of time. So really, really great education. And then yeah, I went to Wharton after that and started Pocket Aces and then Loco. With both those companies, I've been at the kind of frontier or forefront of seeing consumer behavior, especially with regard to entertainment, change in India. And it's been an unbelievable journey. And as someone who's been an avid gamer, to say that I now watch games and help other people watch and stream games for a living is amazing, because then you can, as Buffett says, tap dance to work. So yeah, it's quite a privilege.
I think that's the beauty of it, right? If you can do for a living what you enjoy doing in your spare time anyways, right? I think that's a dream job to have.
Totally.
But Anirudh, just a small quip, right? What are the games that you enjoy playing, which are also streamed on the platform, right? Because I think most of the highly streamed ones are FPS or, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. There's been an evolution of games in India. Obviously, pre-2019, I would say there was no real streaming per se, right, at scale. After 2019, the FPS games in India really took over. Mobile arcade games cracked open Indian gaming, whether it's BGMI or Free Fire, they really got to that 100 million plus MAU mark. And of course, you know, your casual games are still popular. So I'm sure, you know, when you're traveling by the metro or whatever, you'll see people playing, you know, Candy Crush and so on. But from a streamer perspective and from a gamer perspective, these were the games that really broke out. And we saw that in the last year when there's been a suspension on some of these games, we saw GTA has really climbed up the charts. It's one of the largest categories on our platform. Minecraft is doing very well, especially on the VOD side. As far as I'm concerned, I play a lot of BGMI. I'm not extremely good. I'm not bad, but I'm not terribly good. I play a lot of FIFA on the console side, which I love. And there was a time I was extremely good at it. Now I'm pretty good at it. And right now I'm actually playing, you know, Zelda, Tears of the Kingdom. And that's been quite an enjoyable experience. I actually started playing it on my vacation and on my Switch. And so playing that right now. But yeah, last year played, you know, The Last of Us. And it's a game I had not played before, which I quite enjoyed. And it was interesting because I also watched the show alongside. So I would play the game, then I would watch the episode. It was kind of a different way of experiencing the content. But yeah, I love any game. Actually, if you put it in front of me, I would more or less enjoy it. But yeah, amongst the games that are streamed on our platform or are very popularly streamed on our platform, definitely BGMI and FIFA are two that I played. And of course, during the lockdown, everyone played Among Us, which is also popular on the streaming side. But I think since then, its popularity has gone down a bit.
What's BGMI? Like, I'm sorry, pardon my ignorance, but I don't know.
No problem. So BGMI is Battleground Mobile India, which is the Indian version of PUBG Mobile. It's published by Krafton, the Korean studio/company that is behind the PUBG franchise.
Okay.
One thing that I've always been trying to understand is, right, like, what makes a successful game, right? And how important is the streamability factor to the virality or to the success of a potential title, right? We've had varying answers from people who run studios, but as someone who operates the biggest streaming platform in India, right? Like, what are your thoughts there?
Look, I think, you know, just like any other form of content, and this was true even when we did Pocket Aces, and I think one of the biggest reasons why Pocket Aces succeeded is we thought a lot about how will this content that we make get distributed. And I think the same thing is true for gaming. And you have to evolve that strategy based on what your distribution avenues are, right? So if you go back, you know, 20 years and, you know, as a kid growing in the Middle East, I had a Sega, which my dad gave me as a birthday gift after much cajoling from my side. And then you just kind of purchase games, right? Games were kind of consumer packaged goods. You just go to the bookstore or, you know, a general store and just buy them. And that kind of stayed true, you know, whether you bought the original or you bought the, you know, pirated version from Palika, like it kind of stayed true for a long time. But now, of course, when you're building games, if you're doing casual games, there was a phase where Facebook became primary distribution mechanism, right? And so that saw the kind of rise of Zynga, which became a publisher that was fueled a lot by Facebook. And after that, obviously, they've seen a decline, but it's not as bad as people make it out to be. It still did quite well and a multi-billion-dollar outcome, which is a success in my books. And now when you look at any game, right, you kind of have to think about, okay, what's my target audience? Where are they consuming content? Is my game, you know, going to appeal to them from an emotional perspective? What need is it serving? And what's the sort of time limit or investment I'm expecting? Right? So when you look at sort of hyper-casual games, there was a time where, and you know, just a couple of years back, where UA could really be a big driver of growth. You could just put something on Google Play, put a lot of ads out, whether it's through Facebook or Instagram or YouTube or whatever, Google, TikTok, and get your game to become popular on the casual side. That's obviously changed a lot now, given that the new ad rules on Apple and soon on Android will also take effect, which will increase the size of or the investment in terms of CAC, right? So that makes some games unviable now. But if you looked at sort of the large games, which were, you know, multi-AAA studio games, you know, what makes them successful is much like a film, right? It's very large, higher fixed costs. So again, testing at different points, getting audience feedback. And I think, you know, for me, it's very important to understand what emotional, like I mentioned, emotional need you're serving. So for, you know, a wannabe sports athlete or, you know, or a high hardcore sports fan like me, playing FIFA lets you do things you couldn't do, right? So it solves that emotional need. Whereas something like a Minecraft or even an Animal Crossing, Zelda to some extent, it really just is a fantasy land. You're building something or you're going through these different, you know, explorations, and it kind of calms you down, right? So it's almost, you know, for me at least, even building something basic in Minecraft or Animal Crossing, just doing something on it is like therapeutic, right? So that's a very different need that you're solving. And then there's obviously, you know, the FPS, which is kind of action. You're just looking for a thrill, looking for a dopamine hit to some extent, and it's competitive, right? So it gives you these emotional needs. So a pure play game experience is that, but now games have also become community, right? So there are certain games, like I found that with BGMI, and you know, you can find that with many other games now online as well. GTA is a good example on our platform, where it's just a community. People are going and hanging out in the game, and it's not really what they're doing in the game is less important. It's just hanging out. Your friends are there. You're having a good time, and then that's it. And it's a low pressure, right? There's no real big issue with hanging out there. You don't have to bring anything with you. You can be yourself and you can be someone else, right? So it also plays to kind of our need to hang out with other people. And I think that's a big gap that gaming serves, especially in a country like India, where, you know, we don't get to, you know, you may not have the facilities of entertainment that, you know, other big towns may have or a big city may have, like whether it's a big cinema hall or a mall or something. Like, you may not even have proper grounds and stuff to play in. So going and figuring out what someone in Bombay is doing seems like a world away, but through gaming, it's now become possible. And we're seeing that in all the big games that are success. So the short answer to your question is, does the game have to be streamable? Yes, ideally, because it'll help streamers stream your game. It'll help them make it popular for you, and community building becomes much easier. But if you're a hyper casual game and you have a great idea there, and there's still good ideas coming out there, it may not be as helpful because it's not really streamable per se. But for the larger games, all of them have to be made streamable now, because it just forms an integral part of the community and go to market. And for those guys, they can get streamers involved in early, people to come in and get feedback where required. Today, you can even have interesting content that floats in and out. So voice packs, avatars, so on and so forth, that can get made of famous streamers to make your game a bit more famous. So all of those things play an important part. But yeah, bigger games definitely should be streamable. It's a key part of the marketing.
I want to take a step back. I think you mentioned a couple of things. One was that you can be yourself or you can be someone else. And you also spoke of entertainment. What aspects of gaming like excite you personally? And I mean, why is it that you opt to play games? And why do you think that people in general want to play games?
Just repeat the first part. I missed the first part of the question.
Yeah. So I said that you mentioned about you can be yourself or be someone else in games. And there is an aspect of entertainment. So what is it that gets you excited about gaming in general? I mean, I understand that you play different types of games and different aspects of those games might be appealing. But to you personally, what is it about gaming that gets you excited in general? And what do you think, I mean, why do you think people choose to play games?
Yeah, so for me, you know, a big part of what makes gaming exciting is immersion, because you get immersed in the game. And that's why unlike a lot of other people, I spend time in VR as well. I have a Quest and I spend time on it. And the problem is when I put it on, once I cross that laziness barrier of putting it on, I end up spending 2-3 hours on it. I love the immersion. There's no substitute for that in a movie or any other passive form of content. And then from an emotional perspective, I find it much more satisfying personally. Like whether I play a role-playing game or whether I'm in an exploration-style open-world game or whether I'm playing a FIFA, which I think have played every day of my life for the last 3 or 4 years. So for me, it's much more the emotional need of that, you know, it helps me relax and just focus on that thing versus worry about anything else. It's also one of the few places where my hands don't go to my phone and therefore to messages and other things that connect me to the world. You can disconnect, have a good time. So that way it's meditative in that sense. I think for other people, there are, like I said, many other emotional needs it can serve. It can, like I said, can be a relaxation. For others, it can be a thrill. They're playing these games which are high action. For others, it's part of the storytelling or the fan multiverse that they are part of. It can also be a big social experience where they're hanging out with other people and really connect with a community. And you know, I have friends who still remain friends with people online who they may not have met, you know, before, but they've just met online playing some games, right? So I think that's a big emotional need, again, being social, that gets addressed by games. And I think the human connection that comes through this, especially the social side of these games, I think is really important. And I think one thing you will see with, again, when you segment gaming, you will see certain games work across borders, right? Like a Call of Duty can work across many different cultures and genres, FIFA can work across because that's this universal game. But there are other games where they may be more culturally, you know, particular to that area, right? So if you come to India, you've seen Dota doing very well. In the Middle East, there's particular, you know, their own games that have done well because, you know, there's kind of local games that do well. So there is an aspect of gaming, which is like content, where local sort of things also work well. So yeah, I think it's just these emotional needs that get tapped into. And then, of course, like I said, the emotion.
It's interesting you mention Oculus because I used to play cricket growing up. Like, almost until 12th standard. I mean, there are probably very few days where I've not played cricket. And these days, I keep playing IB cricket. So I look forward to finishing my work every night. And then I put on my Oculus. And yeah, I mean, it's great, right? At 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the night, I get to, you know, have my private session.
Do you have the bat as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very well-designed bat. I was very skeptical. I thought, I mean, it looks like plastic, might be cheap. But I think the weight balance, etc., it feels like an actual bat. And yeah, playing ultra instant bowling at whenever you want, I mean, I think that's a really good experience.
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time in that game as well. and I recently had the pleasure of going to Nets at Lords. And I was just, the first thing I was remembering was the Oculus experience. And I'm like, man, how many hours have I spent there? And, you know, it's still obviously not a perfect substitute, but it's pretty damn good. And you go in your own journey there, right? When you're chasing a score or whatever.
Absolutely.
It's a great experience.
Absolutely. Yes.
So Anirudh, when you mentioned in your introduction, right, I think you've built out Pocket Aces, which was a resounding success. And before, prior to that, you had experience on Wall Street, right? So what made you actually leave a lucrative job on Wall Street and then move to creating a consumer-grade startup in of all geographies in India?
Yeah, I mean, look, the growing up, you know, in the Middle East, you saw people from our background building everything around you, right? Then I went to the US, the same thing was happening there. I was seeing Indians doing so well. And then question always was, when are we going to do that back home? And that question always played in my mind. And I think just around, like, you know, around the time I graduated college, I'm pretty old, I graduated 06. So around that time is when the first sort of movement of people started happening in the, you know, into India, and that entrepreneurship started kind of picking up in its, you know, its current version. And for me, you know, the aim was, how do we serve this large audience? What do I do which can help these consumers, you know, as they come online, right? It's not often that you see such a large inflection point happening multiple times. That doesn't happen for most entrepreneurs in their lifetime, right? The fact that, you know, you've had multiple miracles happen in India over the last, you know, call it 10, 12 years. You had internet prices dropping, you know, by a 20th something, right? When I moved to India, I was paying, I want to say, about 3,000 rupees a month. Today, I pay hardly under 200 rupees a month, right? So, you know, and I consume a lot of content. So seeing people save data and, like, you know, track data on Android phones today to people downloading gigs of data, whether it's on movies or games, that's a miracle. The fact that today there is widespread penetration of smartphones also is a miracle, because you've seen a big shift in terms of then digital infrastructure. And then to top it off, you have a UPI where people can now send each other money, improving the sort of transactability between individuals. So those are miracles that don't happen often. For me, you know, back in, you know, 2013, 2014, when I started my entrepreneurial journey, I think for me, it was much simpler. My co-founder Ashwin had already moved to the entertainment industry. We felt that the cultural impact of India was much larger than its economic impact in entertainment, which I still think is true. You know, at that time, the Indian movie industry was about $2 billion in revenue, you know, $1 billion in the Hindi film industry, and the rest was Tamil and Telugu. And, you know, I always wondered that when you traveled and you would meet taxi drivers would know Raj Kapoor and Shah Rukh Khan, and yet we were not able to, you know, this is the size of our industry, right? And on the other hand, like, a Lord of the Rings would show up and it would do $2 billion plus by itself, right? Probably has done more than that. And gee, historically, if you see, there are many movies, and I've been on a, you know, lately I've been on a binge watching some funny old movies. And I, after watching them, I usually just try to see, hey, what is the budget of this movie and how much did it make? And made all these movies made $200, $300, $400 million, right? Some of them have made $1 billion. And that's amazing. And when you think in 2013, the whole of Indian film industry was just that much. That made us think that, hey, there has to be a way for us to change that. And of course, part of entrepreneurship is also fooling yourself or being naive enough to start, right? So that's how we got started. We wanted to change the kind of content that was coming out of India. We felt that popular content in India was very inward-looking and therefore couldn't sell outside. And if you were just selling inside, we just didn't have a big enough market to create a $5, $10 billion sort of impact. And we were, as most entrepreneurs are, we were wrong in many of our assumptions. And when we started, we realized that. And I think what I realized after that is one of the most important lessons that my journey in the last 10, 12 years has taught me is that don't think so much, just start. Because once you start, then you will really learn about the market. Sitting from outside and reading some report by some consulting firm is usually a very hard way of really learning. It's good enough to maybe make a deck or two, but blogs and stuff and, you know, podcasts are good to listen to, but then you have to act. Because once you act, you really see, and then you can really probably have insights that can help you. So that's how we started. And once I got to India, I think the macro of India was obviously great, but the day-to-day positive energy of meeting people who are willing to make a difference, who are willing to change things, that was very infectious. And I think that kept us going in the initial days when things were not easy at all. You know, we used to ask people, hey, we want to make a show. It's going to have 6 episodes. And people were like, oh, you mean like, and these are like writers we were looking at. They're like, you mean for this week, right? And we're like, no, the show is only going to have 6 episodes. They're like, what do you mean? Like, who makes shows like that? And, you know, from there to building some of the most popular memes, et cetera, we really then, once we started making content, we realized what was right, what was wrong, what we could really take advantage of. And that's how we stumbled onto sort of digital content. And we made a very conscious choice then in terms of what platforms to focus on, what kind of content to make. Yeah, and then, you know, we had lots of small and then larger successes.
Oh, for sure. I think one of my favorite shows originated from your startup, right? So little things. I think almost everyone has heard of it or seen it. So I can totally attest to it, right? Like I was reading a little bit about it, how it's based on your experiences at NRI, and the writer was also a part of, was an NRI himself, right? And that helped kind of shape it into what it was.
I mean, we went to the same school actually.
Oh, wow.
In Kuwait. So we knew each other from there. And yeah, I mean, this is the serendipity of entrepreneurship, right? My sister told me that, hey, there's this guy and from our school, you should go meet him. And he's kind of doing something in Bombay. And, you know, just like any other person in the industry, we always say, ha, milna chahiye, or like, we should meet at, we should do something together. That's the...
I can totally relate to it because that's how me and Saurabh got working together as well. Saurabh was my senior at college. And then we stayed in touch, right? When we started exploring Web3 together. So serendipity.
Yeah. And you know, we bet a lot on Facebook because we felt that all the distribution that was actually happening was on Facebook. Even if people were consuming on YouTube, even the link sharing was happening on Facebook. So if you started, built large presence on Facebook, you could really create distribution elsewhere. And that bet really paid off when we were starting with our digital video franchise with Filtercopy. We really bet big on Facebook at the beginning. And in fact, little things also germinated from a short video that we did, which became very popular with Dhruvan Mithila in it. And then we did another video like that because that video did well. And these videos were being made at an extremely small budget. And so we were not burning a hole in our pocket by putting out a lot of money. So we could learn quickly, iterate, sort of. It was very much, digital video was very much aligned with the principles of kind of building from a lean perspective or a lean philosophy versus film, which was exactly the opposite, right? High fixed cost and therefore low innovation. It's not like, you know, the big film stars and the big film personalities don't want to innovate. And this is often the sort of conflation, right? Like, oh, they're just okay with being mediocre, or they're just okay with this. They're not just okay with it. It's just that that's the economic structure of the industry. Every time Shah Rukh Khan takes a risk and the movie doesn't do well, like lots of people lose money. And, you know, the fixed cost is so high that the cost of failure is kind of debilitating. And, you know, you've just seen with them, like, you know, there was a period where people were like writing them off, of course, with Pathani's comeback, you know, he's come back really well. But it shows you the problem of innovation, right? Like, you do a movie that, you know, a movie like Zero, which was pitched to every single big star apart from him, and that we know because we had met some of the creative team and pitched it to us as well. And it's difficult. And, you know, you're not able to, the lead time between your insight and when you deliver it, consumer taste could change completely. Whereas digital video is the opposite, like where you are just quickly making content. You know, we ideate something on, say, a Sunday, and by Wednesday, you know, or Thursday, we'd have the video out. In fact, the most extreme version of that became memes, which is what we really, really, you know, I use this word, like, quote, unquote, weaponized, which is like we went after on the meme side. We grew on Instagram a lot with the kind of memes we put out. And that came primarily by having a culture of high velocity. And so it was very much in keeping. And that's how we then cast our first few actors. We saw they were successful in short videos. We put them in longer form content. Story ideas came from there. And we often tested even endings, or we'd test like what audiences felt about something by just making a short meme or a video about it. And then, you know, the writers would be like, ah, okay, got it. This is what the audience thinks. Right? So you don't have to be guessing anymore. You can actually put out something and the audience doesn't care. And audience doesn't have to know that this is actually input into a show that's coming out of Netflix in 3 months. For them, it's just content. They'll react to it in a most authentic way. So yeah, I think, you know, it's the paradigm we set up was very different from what existed in the industry at that time.
I think I could personally go on and on about talking more about the Pocket Aces journey. But yes, what made you make the switch from what was a resounding success, right, at Pocket Aces to kind of venture into gaming and streaming particularly?
Yeah, I think we had the benefit of being surrounded by young people. And I think the benefit of that is that you get to see and observe a lot of their behaviors, hear a lot about different things that, you know, normally you wouldn't hear in another office or another work setup. And so we were very clear that when with the phone democratizing sort of entertainment, personalization and short video would become big. And that was the first sort of big wave we were part of. And the Pocket Aces direct-to-consumer enterprise or the direct-to-consumer brands were part of that. Post that, we felt, what is next, right? How can, if we want to go directly to the consumer, what is the consumer asking for next? And we saw around us just how much love there was for games. And especially 2019 was huge, because 2019 is when we saw everyone in the office play PUBG Mobile. That's how I learned about the game. I had not played PUBG on the PC. And in fact, I'm not a big FPS fan in general, to the extent that people are. Like, I've never been good at it. I was terrible at Halo, but I played it for fun, but was not like a big fan. But BGMI allowed on the phone that you could do that. I played it a lot, or PUBG Mobile, I played it a lot at the beginning. And really loved it. And actually, a bunch of us in the office started playing it. So from that perspective, we started recognizing the signs for what was to come, which is that, look, you have structurally, the world has changed. There are 100 million plus users of these games. And one sign of something being very large around you is that people around you will be doing it. And we saw it. We saw people, you know, we were part of that journey as well. And we were very sure at that point that, okay, people are going to be playing games. They're going to ask for content, because these sort of games, which are these FPS games, are very much streamable, because you can watch them. There are competitions, esports competitions that can happen on top. They had the right mix of skill, strategy, and action to be fun to watch. And that's how kind of the idea of Loco as a game streaming platform was born. In its previous avatar, Loco was a live trivia app. And again, that idea came from, okay, we've done long-form content, short-form content. What else does the user want? And we saw that there is obviously a natural inclination to be more immersed and get closer to the content. And that's what we did with the quiz version of Loco, which became also very popular. And it also had a unique go-to-market, right? Which is that people could sit, and so see their names on a screen announced by the host, in this case was Gaurav Kapoor, and then play with their family. So the social aspect was there. And then the fact that we distributed the prize money at the end was unique at that time. And that was unique go-to-market. And also we utilized our own filter copy network first. And then on top of that, utilized the broader talent network, which is now very common, right? The influencer movement has become pretty well known now. It was not at that time. And we utilized it before anything else, because we were in that movement and we realized what it could actually do for us.
Shifting gears a bit to Web3 gaming now. So Joel tells me that you have been exploring Web3 gaming for a while. So the first question is, what is it about games in general that leave room for Web3 games?
I think, look, if you look at the human or consumer behavior, right, there's consumption from one person, which is kind of the radio / television effect, that one, or newspaper effect, where there's one editor, one channel blaring out stuff at you and you just consume it, right? And then you did not really have an outlet of discussing it. Then we got to the point where online there was like these bulletin boards, etc., where you could chat with other people and suddenly you wanted to talk about everything else. So that peer-to-peer communication became bigger, which Web 2.0 really picked up very well. Right? So you could communicate very well. The part about Web 3, which interested me, was that how do I own a part of these assets? How do I ensure that I have some bona fide ownership of some of these assets that I'm investing so much time and money into? I find that quite interesting. And that the fact that there is a very clear, you know, to use a slightly more casual term, ownership deed or a title that is available. That actually was the first thing that really interested me about the Web3 games per se, right? And what the promise that Web3 had. And, you know, from our perspective, we felt that first and foremost for Web3 games, they had to be games that you liked. So I think that's the part, you know, took time in the mania that happened, was that people were just like, oh, like, you know, the economy came in, you know, in front of the game, but actually the game has to be fun first. If you don't have a fun game, then it could, whether it's a hyper casual game or a AAA game or a board game, you will not play it. So that's how we started thinking about it, you know, last year and the year.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned, I think we did over engineer Web3 games towards economics, right? Instead of keeping it simple and making them fun to play. I think from the plethora of Web3 games that exist or don't exist, very few, I mean, personally, there are very few, or at least I think there is no game that I would go back to and keep playing. Whereas, like some games like IB Cricket, right? People have to tell me to stop playing. And I mean, I look forward to playing it every day. I don't think there is any Web3 game that exists as of now, which is as engaging. I don't know whether it is the headset and, you know, the environment that it creates. But still, is this due to the economics or financial component that Web3 essentially brings? What are the reasons? I mean, it's been 4 or 5 years since people started developing Web3 games, right? And I think by now, we should have seen at least one or two interesting games that keep audiences engaged. And they play the game regardless of whether there is any avenue of making money through.
Yeah, I think that part that you're talking about, which is the economics in front of the gameplay, is a big part of it. And I think the problem is also when you have something which is just play to earn, then that also sounds like a job, right? Why am I playing to earn? Like, I should be playing to have fun, right? Now, the ownership aspect of it, the economic aspect of it, I think that's the part which is, and it's a very hard thing to do, right? It's obviously easy to make fun of that, but getting any economy right, whether it's Web3 or not, is a big issue. So I think that becomes a big problem. And I think the distribution aspect of it is also tricky, right? So for example, if you have a mobile-based Web3 game, there is high friction. Online, there was quite a lot of high friction, especially in the last year, of course, the regulations changing, you know, getting people wallets, etc. What is my tax? What do I need to pay? Those have become a massive headache. So just getting people online has become a problem. And I think that's a bit of an issue. So go-to-market remains challenging. Also, I think, you know, finally, you know, you don't discuss, right, whether a game was made on Unity or Unreal Engine, right? It's a player. You just say, I'm playing X game. And I think the Web3 part of it has to be underplayed or kept under the surface. It cannot just be like played because it's a Web3 game, but nobody cares about that. So like one of the things which we thought was most interesting was kind of the collectible cards or the Sorare sort of model, which is, hey, can you use, you know, provide a new spin to fantasy and put yourself really in the shoes of a scout, which which you couldn't do earlier. Other games cannot provide you that. And there is a audience where there is a appreciation for that stuff. We've seen it on other platforms. So I think there is still room, and there are brilliant game developers who are working on this stuff. And I think you will see something will definitely break out, in my view, in the next 2 to 3 years, which will not be branded as a Web3 game. It'll just be a game that makes it, and it'll be fun to play. And there'll be some portion of it will be Web3 driven, and other portions will just be kind of like a normal game. So when I say Web3, it means like you will own some piece of that, some of those assets who may become tradable, and therefore with a publicly tradable versus just private, which has been, which has happened in the past. And so you'll see that sort of stuff happening. But a lot of this became, hey, a piece of land, and then to buy the land, and there's nothing there. And then, you know, from a user perspective, these games were hard to play, and there's nothing built. So it became like a like the classic land grabs of the past, where, you know, people are like, hey, buy land here, and there'll be buildings that'll come up, and those buildings never came up. So versus saying, hey, there's a built apartment building, move in, bring your furniture, there's a community. So it's stuff like this which has been an issue. And if you have games which are just giving you money to play Ludo or something, which is, you know, then you, from an audience perspective, you might as well take cash, right? So then you will play some of these real money gaming sort of games. So I think the fun aspect of it still needs to be maintained. And I think the game developer has to think, why do I need an ownership aspect in this? What is the real use or the functionality that is Web3 providing me, apart from just, you know, just economics, which clearly don't always get supported over time. So I think those are some of the things that people will have to think through.
Totally. I think we recently dived deeper into why there is no adoption in terms of real gamers coming in and playing. The simple answer is there's no game which is worth its salt that you might leave a PS5 console or whatever device that you engage on to kind of come to and download that game, play it, right? While it's not available on Steam or any of the other usual places that gamers flock to, right? And that being said, Anirudh, what we are interested to know more, and the audience would love to know, is how does Loco position itself in this journey of Web3, right? In terms of providing tools for streamers, or in terms of a strategy in general, like how do you see this planning out in terms of the features or product that you have that's getting shipped in the near future or is already in production?
Yeah, so we had built a product called Loco Legends. It's a card game, fantasy card game. So it's basically, you know, a fantasy game where you can actually buy cards and then trade them over time. And it was based on tournaments which were happening in the esports world. Now, of course, since then, esports itself got a suspension through the government. And now we've had the sort of GST ruling. So we've actually not taken the product online, even though it's built out. But we felt that model was actually pretty interesting, where you could actually have... So Loco is the place where you could see all sorts of tournaments, all the way from sort of I would give you a cricket equivalent, like a Kanga League, all the way till the World Cup, right? So, or IPL. So you could see all forms of cricket. And in Loco, so you could see any esports tournament, which could be a 1,000-rupee tournament or a scrim, all the way to kind of the biggest and best BGMI and Valorant tournament. So what we wanted to do was let the fans get 2 or 3 value buckets. One was they could actually spot talent early, and therefore buy their cards and keep those assets that would grow in value over time, and they could enter them in fantasy competitions, right? So there was that part of it. Then there was the fandom, which is the collectibles that could be built. And what we wanted was that almost all streamers want to release merchandise, and usually it's a bad idea because you don't have enough demand, and there's a lot of friction in this sort of business where you have to create t-shirts and so on and so forth. But virtual merchandise is something that can be created quickly. We can help people with it, and it can be utilized on the platform. And some of it could be collectible, and those collectibles could be traded. So we've actually built some of those things where, you know, we have things that can be sent as stickers, etc. But we wanted to build those as NFTs, and those could be traded on the platforms. And so fans could really own some of those things that could call themselves super fans, right? And I think that, like, even for me, I'm a big, for example, big Liverpool fan in football. And ultimately, I don't have like 100 people around me who are constantly talking about Liverpool, but online, I'm like part of so many forums and, you know, groups where people are constantly talking about the team and what we should do and who we should buy and so on and so forth. And the tribalism inside esports is just as big or if not more. And there then to stand out that you have XYZ collectibles from XYZ player, that would have value. So that's how we were thinking about it. And then, of course, there are simpler things like, which is like profile pictures and so on, which could also be interesting. But we were concentrating more on this game. And from a go-to-market perspective, obviously, we were responsible for a majority of a lot of esports tournaments that were happening in India. And secondly, we also got the data much earlier than other people. So that allowed us to then give us an advantage if we wanted to build that sort of product. But we kept it on hold right now, given where the macro is on the stuff and regulatory risks on the stuff.
So I want to quickly touch on the GST ruling. One of my friends, he plays poker for a living. And yeah, I mean, he's like one of India's decent poker players. After this, I think e-poker is almost done for, right? You know, at least as far as India is concerned, and all of these people are figuring out where they should relocate. And
yeah,
is it like all real money games or betting platforms, etc., have been affected due to this? Like, what's the scene exactly?
Look, I mean, generally with these sort of regulations, even before this regulation came out, my view was that there are two broad risks that exist, right? One is that some political climate goes against you and things get banned, and it's happened globally, right? If you're in a real money gaming slash game of skill slash betting, whatever, you know, camp you're in, you know that this is a possible outcome where, you know, someone could really ride. And the people opposing it or people who want these to be banned, so on and so forth, have justifiable reasoning. So they're not completely kind of mad or incompetent or whatever, right? So there is some merit to what they say, which is what gives it legs then when it goes into the halls of legislation. On the other hand, there is a simpler viewpoint that, hey, let's tax this stuff. And so always these two risk profiles or risks exist. I think with this ruling, I think it definitely is a negative in multiple ways. One negative is obviously for a table game or place where there's, you know, maybe 7, 8, 10 people playing per pot. It's debilitating, right? Because your odds become horrible. And so why would you play? And look, I love poker as well. It's a great game. First company was called Pocket Aces for a reason. So I think it is hard for those guys. Whether it's the someone who's a professional, of course, it's very difficult. They are likely then going to move because they have to make a living. For companies who have big balance sheets in this, and there are many of them who have done extremely well, they will probably just ride it out. For smaller players, it's going to be very difficult. I don't see big way out of this unless the regulation changes, which it can change. You know, I always say that one thing about regulation is that, you know, it's never static, right? Things do change from time to time. Last year, we had a setback in our sector. This year, it got reversed. You know, things will change. And till these become very settled sectors, you've seen the same thing happen in multiple different sectors when they mature. So I think negative definitely for the table games and those sort of games. For bigger games where there's a bigger price distribution, kind of like, you know, where there's like a tournament and then 1,000 people win, or those kind of pooled games, the hit is lower because the top guy still will make some money. But I think a lot of less people can win or less people get their money back, which means that either the platform will pick up some slack, so they'll make more people win, so therefore their economics become worse, or the retention will become worse because people, you know, this is a simple rule, right? Winners retain in these games. You win sometimes and you come back, right? That's a classic kind of gaming paradigm or a loop. So you want to make people win, but now if, you know, there's so much money that just goes into the tax bucket, then you don't have money to make other people win. So I think they'll get impacted, but impacted less than, say, a direct table game. And then I think the third thing, which is, you know, how does that leave India and the perception of India, right? I think that aspect of it is, you know, that needs to, the government needs to explain some of these decisions better. I don't think, you know, like a lot of people who think this is kind of random, it's, I don't think it's that random. I mean, clearly this has been discussed at a committee level, and there has been due process. So I think just a little more communication there would be good for everyone. But obviously these are all, you know, I think gaming was one of the few sectors in India where the leaders were all profitable and free cash flow positive. So not having that is definitely not a positive from an investment perspective.
Anirudh, I'm actually right now, I was just watching Soul Goblin stream. It's about 5,000 with along 5,000 more people, right? So again, just coming back to the Web3 component part of it, right? Like, I see all of these people dropping in stickers and all of the other things like going on randomly in the chat, right? I think there is definitely scope for incentivizing or ensuring that these streamers can discover their top followers via collectibles, right? So I think, is that something that you have plans for introducing in the short term? Or is there any other thing that we could see apart from the two things that you've already mentioned, which are in the pipeline for collectibles on Loco?
Yeah, we have a full pipeline and a roadmap laid out. I think the biggest concern for us was how do you on-ramp people and how do you ensure that there is an understanding of the various regulations that are out there. So yeah, I think that there is, we would be very happy to put it out there. I think there is a lot of value. You can, I mean, as you were saying, Goblin streaming, you'll always see people sending stickers, right? And the interesting thing is every time we drop a new sticker pack, it gets used a lot, which shows you that it's a consumable and that becomes popular. People want to, like, for example, the Rocket became very popular with Soul. Right. And now it's like continuously, right, they're playing, there'll be like Rocket sent in the chat. Now, who sent the first Rocket? That has value for the fan base, right? There's definitely value to some of these things. And I think, you know, we've built something called Quests, which is not a blockchain feature, but you can see how it is very closely aligned to something that would happen there in that world as well, where streamers can run their own loyalty programs today, right? So they can put various metrics. So some people may optimize for live watch hours. Some people may optimize for engagement through chat. Some people may optimize for stickers, or they may do a combination of these. And we allow them to run these quests. And just to give you an example, we ran a quest recently with two streamers. There was Regaltos from Soul, and there was Blind Rebel from Blind. And the number of stickers that were sent, we created a quest battle between them. And the number of stickers that were sent were more than what was sent for the most successful BGMI tournament in India of all time, just in one stream. So it gives you a sense of how you could use these sort of features to help people express their fandom. And that's where, you know, things like loyalty clubs are very, very applicable to what, you know, Web3 could promise, right? That I can own something that was provided by some person. And, you know, let's say if it shows in your profile, and that's valuable, that's worth something. And if you see in the chat, the moderator has a separate color. We're actually working on features where, you know, there would be, depending on how, what you set as a streamer, your colors could change as a user in terms of how you get perceived in that chat box, because there is social value or social status has value in that box, right? So if everybody's in white and you're in, I don't know, you know, some green color, Soul green or whatever, some Blind red, right? It has some value. So I think there are, you know, use cases for providing a publicly verifiable place where people can actually see that, okay, like, you know, Sid actually owns the first Rocket delivered by Goblin or something. So there is, but, you know, we are also constrained by where the regulations are, and you know, this part, I mean, we have to be respectful of that as well.
I'll just say that this mod bot has had a real tough time on the stream. Poor guy's been banning all of these points.
Yeah, in fact, today we on our streams we have 3 levels of moderation, and still it's like I always say it's like cops and robbers, right? You moderate, and then they find a way out, and you build an embedded tool that helps you, and then they find another way. So there's always that sort of stuff happens.
I think apart from the stream, the live chat in itself is entertainment. If you ask me,
always. That's actually for me, most of the time the live chat is much more entertaining than anything else.
Totally, I couldn't agree more. But I think what you said, Anirudh, makes a lot of sense, right? I think irrespective of Web3 games making it big or not, I think there's definite scope for the, let's say, royalty model to be tested out with streamers and their fan followings, right? Because these exist already on the platform, right? So irrespective, I think unless and until we're dabbling with tokens, I think NFTs could still be the way forward for at least province of fandom. What are your thoughts there?
Totally. I mean, totally. I think that there's a lot of, in the entertainment arena, there's memorabilia and collectibles have always had value, which is why we like the fantasy and collectible together as a model, because then you're not only providing a collectible, you're also providing something that can be used in day-to-day. And fantasy is something India understands, and that's why we like that model quite a bit.
Yeah, I'm quite curious as to what the numbers look like, right? I mean, like for streaming, I understand that different gamers will have different games, will have different numbers of watches and so on. Yeah. So what are those numbers? And like, curious about how your business model works.
Yeah. So on the watch hours, and you know, there are two or three ways to look at quote unquote success, right? Or scale. There is sort of watch hours, which is like how much are people watching, right? So it's number of people into the time watched, right? So that watch hour is a good metric because it shows you how much of a particular game are people consuming. Then there's the concurrency, right? So, you know, is there a big event? So are they all coming together? So, for example, for a BGMI tournament, a large BGMI tournament, we've seen, you know, 200, 300, 400K concurrents on the platform for a single stream. But for a Valorant tournament, it would be much lower than that. It would be in the 40, 50, 60K zone, right? On an average stream for that might be 1,000. Right. Whereas for BGMI, we often see even a normal stream, some goblin or some guy will have 10,000, 20,000. In fact, we've seen Mavi did 87,000 last year. Right. So there's like that scale differences there between BGMI is clearly a very large game. GTA is doing very well. In fact, if you see month on month, it's doing almost as well as BGMI, which is very surprising and very good. Last year, before the ban, Free Fire was doing amazingly well in India, I think. The product market fit there was extremely good. And I think that's still an opportunity that exists in India today, which is that can we get a game which is optimized for, you know, the entry-level mobile phones? Could be a very interesting opportunity. Free Fire is not allowed in our country and we don't, you know, we haven't seen any news of it coming back. So I think that just showed you they were doing huge business in India. And like, I think the GMVs were very high in the hundreds of millions of dollars. So from a, you know, watch perspective, view perspective, these are the sort of numbers you would see on these games. And, you know, today we have, as a platform, we have over 60 million installs. So lots of interest. You know, our monthly active users are in the tens of millions. So there's a huge interest in the gaming sector and in these, and particularly in these games, which are very watched. But, you know, I wouldn't only use watch hours. Now, I actually like seeing stuff on month basis because you can't compare a store that's been running, you know, for 10 years versus a store that just opened, right? Like you have to do some sort of what in detail is called same store analysis. So you have to kind of see, okay, month zero to month one, how much did a game do? And there are new categories. Having said that, I think that there is room for new games, and we will see new games break out in India, whether it's and they may not be just FPS. I think there's obviously a obsession with FPS because FPS has merged. But I think over time, you know, we haven't seen, like, for example, a Genshin or some sort of role-playing game can probably make it in India. And once a good mobile version of those come out, I think we'll see that. And look, we are not far away. In 3-4 years, our PC population will be as big as, you know, some of the bigger markets. So that's also an interesting factor. Moving on to your second question, which is like our business model. Our business model is pretty simple. You know, we have two primary business lines. So there's advertising and there's direct-to-consumer transactions / subscriptions. So, you know, people watch content, we play ads, and we charge the advertisers. That's a straightforward kind of model. And then on the consumer side, we are building, we are yet to announce actually some of the features that we are building out, which are direct to consumer features. We have lots of interesting features there where hopefully, you know, by September, we'll announce some of those.
Excited to see what those are, Anirudh. Another question, right? I think you've mentioned you're obviously bullish gaming in India. What are some of the games or studios that we should keep an eye out for, right? Which are building specifically for the region? Or probably just games that you think are due for release and will potentially do well at the geography.
I think the game that everyone in India was waiting for is Valorant Mobile. I think that if you ask any streamer, that's the game they were all waiting for. But I think that game is going to take some time. I actually also like seeing the demo of a game called Mayan Agri, which is pretty interesting. It's kind of like GTA for India, where you, the friend is working on. It's very interesting. Of course, there's the Indus Gaming, which I've not actually seen the game, but I've heard good things about it. So those are more like Indian games as well that people are liking. But I think most of all, in the last year, people are waiting for BGMI to come back, which has come back, and you've seen the pickup in numbers. I still think there's opportunities for games that are in other genres. Like, I feel like a Clash of Clans could do 10x its user base in India. I feel that something like a Genshin, like I said earlier, will break out. I think there is still opportunity there.
For sure. I think especially Indus, right? Like, we've worked with the team, so can definitely attest to what they're building is going to be special. But let's see until the game comes out, because nothing can be taken for a guarantee in gaming, right? I think it's the thing that makes it very tricky class to invest in, and also to kind of just participate in, right? Because it's very close to the creator process, right? Like, what might be successful and one might not be successful for the other approach. So I think it's always exciting to see what can work in the future.
Yeah, and there are many of the big publishers, whether it's an Activision or some of the other guys, who have thought of games, right? Whether they focus on India or not, we'll have to see. But, we saw last year EA releasing its game, right? The thing is that I feel one of those games will also ultimately end up working well, So the new kind of Call of Duty games, or, whether it's a Final Fantasy, some of those kind of games will definitely make it. And, the guys from the Hoyoverse, if you want to call it that way, who have been Genshin, they're also coming up with another RPG called Zenless. So there are games that people are going to be looking forward to. If you're asking particularly for India, the big question remains, what's going to actually work across phones and what's well optimized? And I think that's a really, really big question, right? I know, for example, even Rainbow Six is coming out with its own mobile game. That's what we've heard. So there's a lot of publishers who have committed. I think now it's just a question of who will actually make it, and what does the audience like next? It's going to be an interesting question.
I have two more questions, Anirudh. So one is, what are the kind of games or things that you're interested in or following closely as a theme in Web3? I'm pretty sure the answer to that can be nothing as well, just because of the lack of interest from players right now. But as a theme, have you tracked anything that's remotely caught your interest in the past 6 months?
Yeah, I mean, the game that I've tracked the most is actually SoRare, because I find that's the best model to follow, per se, in terms of the mechanics, right? Fantasy plus collectibles. And I think while everything is taken a hit in general, I think it's still held up pretty well compared to other games. Other than that, I'm not really followed anything per se in this. I know there are a lot of games that are coming out, but I haven't seen anything that's out yet, which I've played myself, which I can say, yeah, that game's done really, really well.
I think you will be our leading indicator for success of any of these games, right? Because as soon as they start getting steam, that's the big indication whether they will be successful or not. That being said, I think I wanted to dive deeper into the role that the Middle East is going to play, right? I think you've grown up here. You probably spent some time in UAE as well. We've seen a lot of reports and heard about a lot of bullishness coming into the gaming ecosystem from governments and investors, both in Dubai and GCC areas, Saudi and so on and so forth, right? So any takes there? Do you think there is going to be significant traction of both studios and ecosystem builders to the region? And how would you perceive it?
Yeah, I think, look, the regulatory support is very visible, whether it's in the UAE or Saudi Arabia. These geographies have governments and leadership that understands and is willing to support gaming, and they enjoy gaming themselves also. So I think you've seen PUBG Mobile's had multiple big events in Dubai and Abu Dhabi. We had Blast. Had a very big event in Abu Dhabi last year. Of course, Gamers 8, largest esports event in the world, has seen the best of every game, whether it's a FIFA E or whether it's PUBG Mobile, or any other PC game as well. So you know, I think there is a lot of, obviously, incentive and desire to really dominate gaming. I think if you look at from our perspective, if you look at the mobile gaming, that is, the games that are played in India and that are played in MENA are the same. So you see PUBG Mobile here in Middle East, in India, you'd see BGMI and Free Fire. Free Fire's popular in the Middle East as well. Clash of Clans here, Clash of Clans in the Middle East. So there is, the games are like for like. And so you have to be, we know, we've seen this movie before, if you want to put it that way. People will engage with it because they can play these games and they're spending a lot of time on it. From a market size perspective, the MENA region is actually as big as India, right? It's a $2 billion market, growing less fast as in India. I mean, India is obviously bigger in terms of growth rates, but out of the $2 billion in India, there's a lot of that's real money gaming as well, right? In the Middle East, it's all pure gaming. So I think there's a lot of similarity to India. In fact, even in the audiences, there's no two countries are alike, right? So it's much like India where, yes, there's one country called India, but there are many states which have different preferences for different games and languages, etc. It's the same here in the Middle East. So there's a huge potential. And will gaming studios move here? I think a lot of that depends upon how the ecosystem develops. There's definitely many positive factors, right? From a quality of life perspective, access to capital perspective, there is. But there is a long way to go in terms of getting the right talent. So it's not like overnight the Middle East is going to become Finland or, you know. But, you know, in the region also, you've seen some early successes. Turkey's had amazing successes. If you take a broader view of what Middle East is, there's a lot of good game development talent there. Jordan's had some good success. So I think you look at that and then you see that India's right next door. So good things can happen if the right combinations of incentives and financing shows up, because a lot of these games can be built and in different places. So, and I think the governments here are thinking about that as well.
Couple things, right? First, where can people find you, whether you write, etc.? And what should people be looking forward to from Loco, whether it's Web3 or otherwise?
Yeah, look, you know, we have, from our perspective on Loco, we have three big sort of focus areas that we're working on right now. We're working on making the app much more interactive. So we have a bunch of new interactive features that are coming out on the app, which will be announced in the next quarter. We also have a big focus on ramping up monetization in this next quarter. So both on the ad side and on the consumer, direct-to-consumer side, we have a bunch of features that are going live. And then lastly, one really important fact, which as you get larger, is quality of experience, right? When you're smaller, you can get away with more MVP style of operation. Now we're also building in the sort of the right amount of quality in the product. So to ensure that quality of experience is really good for everyone. So those are the three kind of big focus areas for us in the next year, or next two quarters, you can say. And then in terms of my own social, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter, LinkedIn. I'm usually active. I don't write as much as I should, but yeah, I answer almost every LinkedIn message I get. So, and the same thing on Twitter, Instagram as well.
All right. Thanks a lot. This was a lot of fun.